Welcome to Philosophy and Faith, where our goal is to help you navigate your intellectual and spiritual journey, especially in regards to topics like God, faith and doubt, meaning and purpose, and more. I'm Nathan Beasley.
And I'm Daniel Jepson. And together we discuss the big questions that humans have wrestled with for thousands of years.
We're glad you can join us.
All right, so part two of History and Philosophy. As we're getting started here, can you frame this by giving us a little bit of review where we've been the last episode and why it's important to look at the history of philosophy?
I still love that phrase that we talked about last week or last episode, that we study history not to remember the past, but to understand the present. I really find that true.
Yeah, I like that.
Older I get, I'm kind of history myself a little bit, I guess. But I think that's true. Our thoughts and our culture don't arise ex nihilo whenever we're born or whatever. We are one of the branches of the tree that arises from Greek philosophy and Hebrew thought combined. So unless we understand that tree and what it's like, we're not really going to understand ourselves very well. Anyway, that's my thought. So we talked about the, quote, intellectual atmosphere, end quote, of the ancient world. This would be the air that these philosophers would have breathed in. They did not get their teaching and their ideas ex nihilo either, but they built upon currents of thought already in place.
So they're kind of branches in and of themselves.
In a way, but they're more fundamental because obviously they go back much further.
Gotcha. So what were some of the currents that were already in place that we talked about?
One that we talked about was the shapeless dream. The idea that underneath all reality is this undefined force, sometimes symbolized by Mother Earth, from which all living things arise and they live for a while and then they go back into. So it's this idea of a non-personal, fundamental, universal force undergirding all people and animals and other living things, all the things that we experience, that's going to be an unconscious or subconscious foundation of Greek philosophy. Now, what's interesting then, and the reason this is important, is because it's going to presuppose a couple things about reality. Number one, that it's non-personal. So the shapeless dream is not a person, it's a force. And because of that, it's also non-purposeful. So there's no purpose here given by the nature of reality itself. And then thirdly, it's irrational. We don't mean anti-rational, like absurd. We just mean that it's not necessarily based on ration and reasoning towards a goal. And then last, it is also fateful, or is deterministic, is a more technical philosophical word. So the shapeless dream is what determines when you're born and when you die. And what operates that, what brings us about, your birth and your death and everything else, is fate, this impersonal, universal construct or force. And if it controls when you begin and when you end, and that's by necessity, then really has to control all the forces that led up to you in people's lives, as well as the events in your own life. And when you think through it, it becomes totally deterministic.
So that idea of the non-personal fundamental force is summarized by the term fate?
Fate is more what I would say is what operates it, or what determines when things arise and when they don't, and when things arise and when they die.
Okay.
So it's not the same as a shapeless dream. It's more kind of the mechanism by which that shapeless dream operates.
Gotcha. So thinking about the official start of the discipline or practice of philosophy, thinking about the Greek philosophers, that is very rational. So how does Greek philosophy fit into these currents of thought that were already in place by the time Greek philosophy began?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure that Greek philosophy is as rational as most people think that it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, if by rational you mean employing human reasoning and arguments, then yes, Greek philosophy is rational and in a deeper way than we have records of anyway than went before. But if you mean having a foundation that is rational, well, that's another question, because this shapeless stream of fate is blind and purposeless and universal. That doesn't really seem rational to me, but we'll have to see how that works out in the individual philosophers and people can make their own judgment about that.
Okay, so any other thoughts on the last episode you want to highlight before we get into the first philosophers?
Yeah, actually, it'd be good to talk about two other related ideas. One is the idea that humans then are really composed of two different things or two different kinds of things. We have this indestructible and universal life force that has manifested itself. And then we have this actual physical body, which is what it's manifested into. So of the two, one is eternal and unchangeable and universal, and the other comes and goes. And the life force then becomes more important than the individual person, just like a person is more fundamental and important than the clothes he wears one day, changes the next. So this life force takes on forms or manifestations of life, but then those life forms or manifestations go back into the stream. So you have then a unity of the shapeless stream that somehow produces these life forces, as it were, but also you see right from the beginning, then you can begin to devalue the individual life forms or even matter itself, because those just come and go.
Is that like an eternal kind of soul? I know I'm trying to impose our categories onto this philosophy, which I'm no expert in, but I'm just kind of curious because that's almost what it sounds like to me.
Sure. No, you can use that word. It's not a word that would have been used before the Greek philosophers came about, but it's a word that some of them would use, or especially later. Even Hegel would talk about a world soul that seen something like this. Of course, I mean, he was a German writing in the 19th century. So it's not too dissimilar from some idea of a world soul. And yes, some of the Greek philosophers would use that kind of terminology or concept.
Gotcha. Okay, well, anything else before we jump into the first philosophers?
Well, the other thing, because you have this shapeless stream and then you have individual things, you have this problem that's going to be really fundamental in Greek philosophy. And that is how the one and the many fit together. So you've got one shapeless stream, right? And then you've got lots of people with lots of animals and lots of things, the many. How those fit together, or if they can fit together, is going to be one of the fundamental questions. And I think when I was studying philosophy, when I first ran into the history of philosophy, I didn't get that at all, because we had heard about this idea of the shapeless stream that predated the philosophers, as it were. So it helped me really understand that they're working in these intellectual currents and issues and problems that to them seem very obvious and fundamental. Some of the answers then will be more understandable if we keep that in mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what marks out the Greek philosophers as the first philosophers?
Yeah, that's a good question. And some people would say it's a loaded question because it's assuming that they were the first philosophers. And that's a fair point. We have to recognize that people in Egypt and Babylonia and probably many other places thought about deep philosophical issues, the issues of ultimate reality. But primarily, three things would make the Greek philosophers have that title of the first philosophers. One, their ideas were written down in a somewhat structured way, and therefore subsequent thinkers could interact with their ideas in writing, push back and clarify and give their own opinion. And then second, they sought knowledge for knowledge's sake alone.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Going back to Hegel, again, writing much later, but he dismissed Indian philosophy rather curtly as being nothing else and nothing more than Indian religion. And what he meant by that is that both had the same goal, the practical purpose of freeing people from the illusions and unhappiness of life, rather than seeking knowledge for its own sake. Now, I'm not sure if he was right to conflate those two, but I think he makes a good point. Philosophy seeks to know, period. It doesn't seek to know for religious purposes, as valuable as those might be. It doesn't seek to know for cultural or political purposes, but it simply seeks to know, period. Knowledge for knowledge's sake.
Okay, so what's the third thing that makes these Greek philosophers philosophers?
Well, the last thing is that the Greek philosophers were the first thinkers that we know of to seek answers to the basic questions of life and reality based on human reasoning alone. That is, they did not base their ideas upon pre-existing and authoritative beliefs like religious ideas or scriptures or the traditions of mythology. Now, again, it's not to say that all their ideas arose ex nihilo. We already talked about that. Philosophical ideas and cultural motifs already abounded, and these were pervasive and unavoidable. But they did not have texts or traditions or a priesthood that prescribed or proscribed how they could answer the questions that they were asking. So that's one of the main keys, is this autonomous human reasoning. It's going to be about human reasoning alone, not by the traditions they've received by the elders or by priests or by some text. And this really actually brings up an interesting point, one that I think is ignored in most history of philosophy books, at least the ones that I've seen. And that point is this, that to make this work, to do philosophy in this way, you have to have a presupposition, a foundational belief. And in this case, one that is assumed instead of examined or argued for by the very thinkers who are going to employ it.
Okay, so that sounds pretty interesting and important. So what's that presupposition?
The presupposition is that autonomous human reasoning, that is human reasoning unaided and unsupplemented, is a sufficient tool to understand the big questions that philosophy has. That's the big presupposition.
Yeah, that's big. I feel like we've interacted a little bit with that in the past, talking about epistemology.
Right. But here at the beginning, they're not even asking that question. And in fact, it won't get asked for a good deal later. But it leads to a big problem. And the problem is skepticism. Because you're making a presupposition that human reasoning can give all these answers, but you're not examining, or you don't have proof for that presupposition itself.
So what do you mean by skepticism in that point, that people can push back against that presupposition that reason alone can get you there?
Well, more than that, they push back against the idea that you can have true knowledge of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very difficult to escape if human reasoning unaided is your only way to discover truth. You don't know if the tool is adequate, because the only means by which you can examine it is by human reasoning itself. So the instrument is the only thing that could test the instrument, but if the instrument is already faulty, then you would never know, because you'd have a faulty instrument testing itself, basically. And that idea of skepticism is going to come roaring into Greek philosophy. It's going to be one of the deep issues. In fact, I really think it's probably the most important philosophical problem. It keeps rearing its head. It's going to come back in Greek philosophy. It's going to come back later in the Middle Ages, not to quite such a degree. But then in modern times, starting with David Hume especially, but also in postmodernity, skepticism is a problem.
Skepticism, again, about the validity of building on the Greek philosophers because of the faulty, maybe circular reasoning presupposition?
No, skepticism about the ability of us to know anything at all.
It's a really interesting point.
Yeah, and I think it's such an important issue. It's like, we're assuming autonomous human reasoning can do this. But have we confidence in that assertion? How would we establish that as a fact that we can?
Yeah.
What's the warrant for that belief?
Yeah. So not to say that the Greek philosophers were wrong about a lot of stuff. They were right about a lot of stuff.
Sure.
But also that it's going to be limited. It's going to be limited because this foundational question is difficult to answer from their worldview.
Well, I think so. And one of my goals is that perhaps people can think through, does philosophy of the Western tradition actually work if it's not based on anything other than autonomous human reasoning? I'm skeptical of that. I think there are significant and foundational problems with that, but we'll let others judge for themselves.
So real fast, and then I want to get into Thales, the first philosopher. We talked in the past that if you aren't just using reason, then we talked about also revelation. So the Greeks don't believe in any sort of divine revelation as part of their epistemological framework.
Well, the Greek philosophers do not.
Okay. Yeah.
So whether they believe in the gods or not, they're not using any sort of revelation or tradition or mythology to establish their viewpoint.
Okay. That's interesting that their practice of philosophy doesn't take that into account, even though they're living in a very polytheistic culture.
And that's both a glory, but also perhaps a weakness. It's a glory. It's what makes it philosophy.
Yeah.
But at the very heart of it, then you have this question. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, let's dig into the early philosophers or the first philosopher. So I think you mentioned Thales last week. We're going to unpack that a little bit more today. So tell us about Thales. How do you say his full name?
Thales from Miletus, because he's from a large city called Miletus. A little bit of background here for history. The first three philosophers we're going to look at are all from Miletus, which is interesting. Miletus is going to be a town on the west coast of what we would now call Turkey, but it's a Greek town. About 5 centuries before this, 4 centuries before this, you had what's called the Doric invasion, where the Greeks talked about these people called the Dorians who were coming in and taking over much of the mainland Greece. And so many Greeks at that time crossed the sea and went over and established these colonies. Some of them became very wealthy and powerful, like Miletus. Eventually, they established colonies of their own.
Okay, and you said of that time, what kind of time frame are we talking about here?
So the Doric invasion is usually about 1100 BC, but Thales we're looking at, most people think his birth, about 620 BC.
Okay.
And we don't really know that, but the records say that he predicted an eclipse that came about 580 BC. So people are thinking, well, if he was maybe 40 at that time, that seems like a good guess, and we'll go back 40 years before that for his birth.
Okay.
But yeah, they didn't have Wikipedia back then to kind of put these things down.
That's too bad.
I know.
It's a good tool.
So Thales and the early Greek philosophers are going to be most concerned with not ethics, but we would probably call ontology. Some people would call metaphysics. Those two terms tend to get blurred a lot. The idea of trying to figure out what's ultimately real. So they're sometimes called physicist philosophers because they were as involved in science as philosophy. The division between science and philosophy, that was not a division that existed in the ancient world.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I already told you he predicted an eclipse, apparently. There's another story about him looking at the natural world and discerning when there was going to be an abundant olive harvest. And he bought all the olive presses in the village and the surrounding area and made a fortune when the time came because he controlled all the presses for the olives. Again, these are kind of legends. They may or may not be true.
So he's a philosopher, a physicist, an astronomer, and into agriculture.
Man, they were the whole package back then.
Yeah. That's pretty sweet, yeah.
And he's not the only one. Most of the others are going to have the same background. So he was not simply teaching in a university or writing tomes. That was not his day job. That would not be a job, actually, for a good while after him. But what he's known for is he's the first one that we know of who systematically taught a philosophical idea which could be interacted with, which wasn't based upon myth or tradition or religion. And he was really concerned to understand the ultimate nature of reality, the one, what it is that makes everything what it is. There's a Greek word called arche, which can be translated principle. Sometimes it just means what the cosmos consists of or from which it comes into existence or both. Now, Aristotle, when he was writing about this a few centuries later, he said, the arche is that of which all existing things are composed and that from which they originally come to be and that into which they finally perish. This, they state, is the element and the principle of things that are.
It's like matter?
Yeah. Let me read that again.
Okay, yeah.
Because I didn't read it very well. Aristotle, looking back on these early philosophers, and especially Thales, said, the arche, quote, is that of which all existing things are composed, and that from which they originally come to be, and that into which they finally perish. This, they state, they being the philosophers, is the element and principle of all the things that are. Now, that's what Thales is going to look for, and he's going to give one answer that he's kind of famous for. He's going to say it's water.
Water.
Yeah.
Everything comes from water. Everything returns to water. Water is the base substance of everything that is.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
that. Why water?
We're not told, but reading between the lines, I mean, water is ubiquitous, right? It's in the sea, falls through the sky, runs in your veins. You cut a plant, you see it has liquid inside. We and all the animals and plants die without it. It's essential for life. Maybe you could say water could be said to produce the earth itself, because in their cosmology, the earth was floating on waters and underneath the waters of the sky. And probably, again, this is reading between the lines, water is the only substance that Thales knew of that can occupy the three material states, right? It's solid and liquid and gas.
Oh, yeah.
So you might indeed say, hey, this is a pretty good choice.
Yeah, yeah.
His particular answer, though, is not really as important as a question he asked. What is everything made of? What's the underlying principle? What's the unity of all things? And the way that he answered. Again, he's trying to give an explanation by human reasoning, observing the world around him, instead of looking towards tradition or understanding what a religion would say about that. It's only on the basis of unaided, autonomous human reasoning.
I see. So he didn't receive that from any sort of cultural myth or from any scripture or anything like that. He's just observing and trying to understand using his own mind.
Right. And that's what makes it important. The questions he asked and how he answered it.
Okay.
The particular question, water, is not really going to be that important in the history of philosophy.
That's really interesting. So that's the birth of when we talk about philosophy as a discipline or practice.
It did.
Wow.
So that was one thing he was famous for. And the other phrase or aphorism that he's famous for is more ambiguous when he said, everything is full of gods.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
What did he mean by it?
There's different interpretations. It could be an early form of pantheism, but most people don't think that that's it. It's more probably this idea that, it could be an attempt to give just a rational direction to the random flow. So there's this water, but then what makes it work the way it does that it produces these individual things, like you, all right? If you're fully water, then why are you different than, say, a goat or a sycamore tree, you know?
Yeah.
So some people feel like he would say that somehow the gods are involved in that. And so somehow they direct that. And so therefore they're everywhere. Or another way of thinking of that, another way to interpret him is that he's viewing gods as simply another word for this life force, this shapeless stream. So scientifically you'd call it water, but philosophically you'd call it the gods, but it means the same thing. Not sure what he meant. There are interpretations of that. However, this begins the first problem that you have with Thales, and more broadly, again, using him as an example of using autonomous human reasoning alone. If water is everything, and everything is water, and all things are full of gods, well, are the gods also then made of water?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah. So if they are water, like Zeus and Apollo, so if they're just water themselves in godlike form, then they are victims or controlled by the flowing streams, not controllers of it. So if they're not, then everything's not really made of water. There's something more fundamental. But more importantly, and I don't know where I've seen this really brought out too often, but to me, this is an obvious question. All right, if everything is full of water, does that mean that the mind making that statement, everything is full of water, is itself just water? And if it's water, that's just waves and wavelengths, occurrences that just happen to take place in the movements of my inner sea. So my thoughts, just like your thoughts, are just somehow water or the movement of water. But if there's no way to judge which of those two movements of waters can be more correct than the other one, right? Why should we think that one wave is more true than the other, more valid or more illuminating, more profound? So again, draws us back to this question that I think is unanswered. Can autonomous human reasoning adequately explain reality? And if you give some of these mechanistic natural answers, I don't think you can say that, because then the human mind itself that produced that claim is also the result of those same processes.
Yeah, this sounds like a familiar conversation that people have been listening a while.
Yeah, we talked about this with naturalism. There is an argument that I think it's a good one, that naturalism is self-defeating for many of the same reasons.
Yeah, yeah. If the mind making the truth claim is the byproduct of processes that aren't made in order to try to understand truth claim that they're making, then it's kind of self-defeating.
Exactly. And if the mind is made of water, who's to say that that water is fighting truth? And if your mind and my mind have a difference of opinion, but they're both just water, why should I value my opinion over yours?
Wow, that's super interesting.
And that's where we'll leave it for today. We'll talk about the philosophers who came right after him next episode. But I wanted to talk about him just to give an illustration of some of the themes that we've already been discussing a bit.
Great, great. Well, thanks. Looking forward to the discussion next time.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, click follow or subscribe depending on your platform. Check the notification bell so you're up to date with new episodes and leave us a review. Until next time.